Continuing interview with Mr. Hank Messick. And so you were going to tell us about the April Flowers incident.
Well, it was in 1961, and the Ratterman arrest frame had already occurred. And we had had the Courier-Journal had covered that, but somehow or other, there wasn't too much enthusiasm, as always. And I got tipped by the FBI, by Frank Staub of the FBI, I guess it's going to hurt Frank to say this now, that April was talking. And it was pretty apparent she'd been before the grand jury. So I also got a little help from one of the assistant United States attorneys, who is now, or was, a going into private practice, I think, in Lexington. But anyway, they told me where I could find April.
Thank you.
And she was in, allegedly in St. Louis. So they gave me her number. She was in a theatrical hotel in St. Louis. So that particular day was extremely busy. I don't know what was going on, but the paper had really snowed under, and they had me doing a routine job, a half dozen assignments. And I kept telling them I need a little time to do something on Newport, and the city editor was saying, we've got to heck with Newport. But anyway, between the other routine assignments, I managed to put in a call to St. Louis, and lo and behold, I got her on the phone, and I dropped some names to the FBI and everything, in effect, and giving her the impression they wanted her to talk to. And so she said she would. So desperately, I looked around the room trying to figure out, I got to have somebody, some witnesses or something. Orr Spade, who was the paper's religion editor, sitting by me doing nothing. I said, Orr, pick up the phone and listen to this. So he did, and so she told a whole story of how she'd been brought in and how Ratterman was framed and how they pulled off his trousers and took him to the police station and so forth. And I made notes. I wish to hell I'd had a tape recorder. But I made notes and told him, unfortunately, or caught on to the importance of it, and he made notes. So then I finally got my other assignments done, and I went in and told him I had this hot story. Well, we can't handle that. That's too. We need more. We got to have more support. Can't take the word of somebody down in St. Louis, just a voice on the phone. But fortunately, I had Orr as a witness. But they finally agreed, the thing to do is go down there and talk to her and get an affidavit, get her to sign an affidavit. So I called her back, and she said she'd be willing. So I flew down to St. Louis the next day, located her in a seedy little hotel. I located the hotel, rather, but she wouldn't come down.
Uh-huh.
She was waiting to be on the show there. Somebody had gotten to her. Somehow she got scared. She decided she wasn't going to talk anymore. Certainly wasn't going to sign it. So I couldn't. It was a waste of time. I thought to go down there in the first place, but still, I had to do what the paper said. So I went back to Louisville, and I called up before I reported to the editor, I called the paper's attorney, who was Wilson White. And I said, look, why in the hell can't I write this story? And I outlined the whole thing, how she talked over the phone, how the FBI had told me to find her in the first place, how Orr Spade had heard everything, how I'd gone down to St. Louis and at least proven that she was, established that she was where she was supposed to be at the time, so forth. He said, well, if you can get the FBI to confirm everything she's told you, then I'll tell them to run the story. So I got a hold of Frank Staub, and the FBI in those days, you had to work very carefully with them because they couldn't be in a position of giving information, etc. But Staub and I understood each other, so I called and said, look, I've got some good information for you. I want you to listen carefully and tell me if it's, and use it if you want to. So I told him, I read him the story. And he said very loudly, Hank, there's nothing in that we don't already know. We've got every bit of that information. It's all true, we know, but there's nothing there we don't know. Thanks very much. And that's the kind of charades I had to play with the paper, with the FBI, with everybody else. So I was then able to go into the editor and say, look, I've got the thing, and the lawyer says it's okay, and the FBI has confirmed that it's all true. So they had a great debate. And I don't know, it seemed so stupid to me, but they finally ran the story on the front page. And a wire picked it up, and the Cincinnati papers came out with it. It was allegedly the turning point in convincing the public that Radiman really was framed. Mm-hmm. And
could I ask a question about this incident now?
Yes, I was going to ask about Radiman.
The thing that I have heard, in fact, Vince Stegman told me that after that incident, a number of them called a press conference that morning and had the local press in, and even had this photographer who indicated and said that he was supposed to show up there, which, you know, would indicate the frame, and that the local press didn't touch it or do anything about it. Could you say anything about that? Is that, do you know anything about that, their refusal to portray it as a frame, the idea being that they wanted to portray him as really being in that room and having perhaps an affair with April Flowers?
Yeah. Well, I heard that same story that they didn't show up, and the fact is it boomeranged against it. And there wasn't apparently even a very period of hours in which anybody really believed it was Frank. I know one of the ministers said he was out on the street, or maybe it was Cesar Bernardino, and said, the word came down the street, that's like 1-2. Radiman's arrested, too, it's a frame.
Hmm.
I think the thing is that by the time that they were going to have a photographer of their own there, you see, to take the picture. And he was a witness who later double-crossed him and told the truth and didn't show up. But it was 3 a.m. about the time, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, by the time they finally got into the police headquarters, and apparently the papers didn't bother to come over. But they sure as hell played it like hell, as if it was...
Yeah.
Yeah, they played it so it could have gone either way. And they didn't really get out there and knock themselves out proving it was a crime. I think the Miami Herald, if it hadn't been for the Herald, I mean the Courier Journal, what am I talking about? If it hadn't been for the Courier Journal, I think they would have let it go along as it was. But we were the extra force there, and they couldn't do it very well.
But they would have let it go on ahead, is that he was actually...
By this time, you were a force in this, too, right?
By then, I was a major force.
Well, did... how did
61, you see. I've been going there for 3 years.
How did Radiman let himself get let into this?
Well, it's not as amazing or ridiculous as it seems. Radiman was a healthy man with a lot of confidence in himself. But he thought he could handle it. This guy suffered, or Carenzi approached him, and sort of set up this meeting, giving the impression he was going to talk and spill all and tell everything. And Radiman thought it was a good chance. Everybody, you always look for somebody on the inside, you know, to come out and talk. And so apparently he figured meeting in Cincinnati would be safe enough.
Right.
And he was simply trying to get a political plus. If Carenzi had really come over and unloaded on everybody, it would have been a big hit. So I think he was entirely justified in meeting with him.
And he was, I guess, Radiman by this time, too, kind of followed the theory. I thought you had always followed it. You plunge into this and go rather boldly. You don't go in halfway. Did you like George?
Oh, yeah, I liked George very much.
Did
a lot of people did. You know, not a lot of people, but some of the federal people thought he was a little, he was too self-assured, a little, they thought arrogant, maybe. But I got along fine with George.
Were you pleased with what Radiman accomplished during his years?
I think he did far more than he might have expected him to do. I really did.
One of the men that called me after this came out, and I was kind of interested, was a Republican opponent. You know, that Republican Party also was splintered, obviously, and was telling me sort of how the Radiman era ended, and he mentioned that he was eventually defeated, and this, I should know this, but Radiman was in, what, just one term as sheriff?
Yes, he couldn't repeat himself.
He said that he was defeated by Andy Jolly. That couldn't have been, though. Jolly, unless he meant by this the Jolly-led faction of the Democratic Party, and the Democrats sort of reinserted themselves after this.
Well, that was one mistake they made, and I sort of blame Henry Cook for that. It was they achieved their victory there. They cleaned up the town on the basis of a bipartisan committee of 500, Republican, Democrat, Catholic, Protestant, anybody. It was only when they tried to channel that into political channels and make Ratterman instead of a candidate of all the people, he became a Republican candidate for Congress. That was a mistake. He could have run in some fashion as an independent and still kept all that support. But I think Henry was looking for a little partisan advantage there. He was a Republican, hard and fast. He was a great guy, a wonderful fellow, and a brave man, but he was a partisan man. I think that was their big political mistake in lying there. But that happens inevitably. And there might have been something else. A reform movement can't keep its body in very long.
Can I inject this question now, Lou, about that on the matter of politics? The impression that I get in looking at certain personalities and so on is that you did have, and this is not partisan on my part, obviously I have to be a registered Democrat, but that you did have more Republicans as taking a lead, and that than Democrats as far as the quasi-political figures were concerned in the reform movement. Is that right?
Well, I think that's probably true. I never thought of it in those terms at that time. But some of these businessmen, I presume, were Republican.
Yeah.
I was thinking I'm a strictly businessman. Of course, Henry Cook was a Republican. It didn't get into the politics in that era, 60 and 61. It wasn't thought of in those terms.
It was thought of
the big division, and I can't emphasize it too much, though. Perhaps it's a little controversial to talk about it. But the big division was the division between the Catholics and the Protestants.
Right.
My next question.
And she was held. The Ratterman's key move there was when he finally got the Bishop of Covington to come out with a statement about throwing out crooked political officials. That won the election for him right there. Because until that time, all the reform agitation and pressure had been coming from the Protestants. And that got the Catholics in on it, and made it a sort of a united thing. But it was the Protestants, not only in Newport, but finally around the state. You know, it was a statewide campaign, and churches in not only Kentucky, but Indiana, and all in Ohio were raising money for these ministers to help them with their fight.
I'm going to say this on tape, but I told Frank, I said, you know, that I could understand this in a sense, because the Catholic Church and gambling are not necessarily unknown to exist, and one of the things I was thinking of too was that the gentleman pointed out that he admired Ratterman immensely for going into that at a time when it was not history but living fact, and however, he said that what happened was that after Ratterman was in, that not so much Ratterman, but those who worked for him, turned the movement from reform to sort of an ongoing petty harassment that took the heart out of the reform. Do you think that was true, or was this, for example, that they broke into... that they set up numbers of people out in these little bars. They would ask for a drink.
They had what was referred to as Ratterman's Raiders.
Yes.
They were also known as Ratterman's Rats. But basically what it was, the members of the whole Social Action Committee and that was going around sort of keeping an eye on things. I don't suppose you noticed coming into this area here, but they just put up yellow signs saying, "This neighborhood protected by Crime Watch."
No, we didn't.
What they got is allegedly all the citizens who live here keep their eyes open for any law violators they see running around. It's become the latest thing. I don't know how effective it is, but that basically is what they were doing in Newport then. And I frankly didn't see anything wrong with it.
Right.
It could have been misused, of course. It takes somebody, if Ratterman had certainly should have kept a close watch on these people and seen that they didn't let it turn into a personal arrest.
Mm-hmm.
How else? I mean, he didn't have that big a police force or that big a staff of evidence. He had to have some way of keeping an eye on it. And how else? What better thing to do than to get the community involved in good law enforcement? I think that was a damn good thing.
Unless
it was carried too far after I left.
Was there a great deal of conflict between the city police forces and Ratterman's?
Hell yeah. The city police force was completely corrupt.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a joke. There wasn't any pretense. One of the most amusing things I may have written about this, there was a chief of detectives, Leroy Fredericks, he got indicted along with the Google. And moved from office. But anyway, he was, I'd always gotten along with him. Sort of a game with him. But he told me one day, he said, Hank, I'll tell you what let's do. Let's take a stroll down York Street and Monmouth. Every now and then, wherever the two people will stop, and I'll point and I'll say something, and you'll scare the shit out of these people. I went down, I had experience one time during that period, just before the, everything really closed up, but I walked down one the street, York Street, I think it was one day, and apparently I had an appointment, and I was a little early, and anyway, I leaned against the lamppost and standing there thinking about something, and I looked across the street, and saw all these guys peeping out the front window, this joint, just a cheap bar. And so I saw them watching me, and so then I began to look like I was waiting, looking at my watch. Next thing I knew, the side door opened about 15 men ran running out the side. So I had a lot of fun at times there, but I was scared to death at other times.
I just, yeah, we were wondering if you, because...
Worst experience I ever had, and something that today you tell a reporter, and I know the Washington Post did a feature article about me a year or two ago, and he couldn't believe this, he said he sounded like something out of Thunder Road or something. But I'd been up to Newport for some particular hearing or meeting or something, about 2 a.m. when I started back, and that was when before they had the new road, the road went down that old river road, parallel river all the way. I was driving along, I suddenly noticed a light in my mirror, and I looked back, and there was a car coming. And the next thing I knew, there was another car behind me, and they were coming on awful fast, and they kept gaining on me. I wondered who in the hell they were going and where they were going at that time of night. So they came right up behind me, and one of them went around me, and the other one pulled in behind me, and there I was sandwiched in between. And I noticed there were only two men in each car. I didn't talk about being scared. I said, "My God, you really wanted adventure." And I began to think that right on down the road a piece was where the place where the road went right next to the river.
Mm-hmm.
I was sure that that's where I was going to end up. And I finally waited until another car was approaching from the south, cut out in front of the one in front of me, and almost had a wreck getting squeezing in. Took off and pulled into a side road, roaring on by. After a while, they came roaring on by. Later on, I heard in Newport, they just sent these guys out to scare the
dog.
They weren't going to kill me, they said, but they were going to scare them.
Did you ever think, I think you put in here that they refined frame-up to a fine art.
Oh, yeah. One thing I was worried about. There were several times in which I received calls in which I would take somebody with me. It was obviously a frame-up had been intended, but...
Were you married then, by the way?
Oh, yes. That night I was chased. When I got on, finally got back in the road and came on home, it was 4 a.m. when I got there. I got to thinking, I can't tell anybody at the Herald about the Courier Journal about this. I can't write it. I can't tell it. If I do, they never let me go back up.
Uh-huh.
They say it's not worth getting killed. And I couldn't tell my wife about it. Uh-huh. They just worried her and scared her. So I was sitting there with nobody I could tell what had happened to. I crawled in the bed. Felt very lonely.
I did remember one statement you made that when the police raid on lookout and they were looking for a local magistrate and the fellow said no, and then he said, "I have wife and children," and you said that there was never any evidence that the syndicate had ever harmed women or children. Did you have children? Did you
have children?
And. So I was very interested. I'm looking for these little things.
Well, allegedly, at one point, I think it was in 1960, I was told that they had a meeting above the Flamingo Club. They had sort of some executive officers above Sleepout Lewis place to decide what to do about it. And some of the younger guys wanted to hit me, and others said, you remembered what happened to Jake Lingle in Chicago, and advised against it. And an effort was decided on to bribe me. They figured every man has his prize. And I was approached shortly thereafter by Bales Bond from Louisville, who had worked in Newport and had connections.
Mm.
And he offered me a bribe, but he offered me to stay away from Newport. It was a perfect thing. He didn't have to write anything or do anything. And all I, he knew as well as I did that all I had to do was tell the editors, "I'm scared to go back up there." wouldn't say.
Did they offer you a price? No, they give you a figure or just open-ended?
It was sort of open-ended, but he said, how about 5,000? Uh-huh. I said, a month. But I was told, I'd been told long before, a Cincinnati reporter, I forgot his name, but he was one of the better, or at least a decent guy. He'd just been assigned, he was on the Inquirer, just been assigned. He came to me all puzzled. He said, he was an old guy who had been there for many, many years. He says, the minute I got over to Newport on the first day, this guy come along, said, we'll have to get you on the payroll. I said, what do you mean? He told him, well, you get paid off yet. Part of the routine. He said, could he be telling me the truth? I said, hell yeah. That was the same guy, this old fella. I found a story in which he had said the Newport Police Department was one of the most admired and respected in the entire country.
This old fella was a reporter?
Yes, the Cincinnati Papers. Been there for years.
Or the Post or Inquirer, you remember?
I think it's the Post.
That's very interesting, isn't it?
They were on the payroll. I mean, it was just acceptable.
So you got
one night up there, I was in there in 1960, when we had the sheriff was indicted, and they were trying to decide whether I'd let them to go through the farce of the trial. And they passed the word, apparently, that they were going to try him, and they wanted him to be able to get in on the stand next day and say there's no gambling in Newport. So the word passed to close everything down. And that was one of the most fantastic scenes I've ever seen. I got there just fairly late, early in the evening, and went up and all this crowd was pushed out of the Yorkshire at the first place I went. And I said, what's going on? And they said, they're closed down. And I went in and they were tearing down the tables, everything, and making no bones about it. I went on over to the Flamingo, across the street, same thing, everybody being pushed out. Cab drivers were coming like vultures from Cincinnati, saying, here for girls, here are best girls in town, cleanest girls in town. All these tourists were trying to find alternate entertainment. Went over to the snack bar and they were even pulling down the wallpaper. And there were two guys playing cards and they were right in the middle of all this and they weren't going to interrupt. I said, what's going on? And somebody said, the sheriff's in trouble, we've got to close down. I hope it'll only be for a day or two. So here I was in the middle of a story. Well, I was thinking more of the crusade or the campaign than I was my own paper. I went outside and called Cincinnati paper, both of them. I said, for God's sake, send a reporter over here and get this story. Well, they didn't bother. I called in just a bulletin, a paragraph or two to the Courier Journal, but it's too late for me. But they just did that in the cover.
Frank, do you have some questions you can ask?
Yeah, just one or two other things. Connection with the role of the Committee of 500, and I know we can't make judgments on this, but do you got the feeling that the Protestant ministers group for the Committee of 500 of businessmen was more effective and contributed more in the move against crime?
Well, they actually divided themselves into two phases. The Ministerial Association got started and built up the public opinion to the point where the businessmen really thought they could do something. And as one of them put it, one of the businessmen put it to me, he said, the ministers carry the cross, we carry the flag. They considered they had a definite different areas of responsibility. And their aim, of course, was for the political, to find the candidates. And they sponsored Bradham. Of course, the Ministerial Association endorsed it. But they continued their separate campaign on moral grounds, whereas the Committee of 500 pitched it on a business grounds on the fact that this is not good for the economy and so forth. And so they worked by working together, they were able to touch all bases and were vastly effective. So I couldn't say that one was more effective than the other because they sort of compensated for each other. They definitely helped each other out and each had a separate area of responsibility.
I believe Henry Jose was the last chairman of the Committee of 500.
Henry's a great guy.
He is. He's a good friend of mine and neighbor.
Give him my regards, you see.
I surely will. Do you think of another name there in connection with businessmen maybe mentioned? I had the name of Mr. Bennett, Reverend Bennett, as another minister to say something to you. We have a lot of names. The catch is, we won't say that you said so-and-so was more important than someone else, but to get the
Another businessman out there, an older guy.
Stegman or Wadsworth, either one.
Wadsworth, I guess.
Duck Wadsworth. Duck Wadsworth.
No, maybe not. There was someone else. I believe it was his only headman. Rodman had his victory party the night he won election.
I can find out that very easily, because I think Stegman will know about that.
Stegman's a younger guy.
Vince. Yeah. No, Vince is... Was it Jack Steinman?
Jack Steinman.
Oh, Jack.
No, it wasn't Jack. Jack was, he was a younger guy. He was young. He was very important in it, too, since he was filling in on both the Social Action Committee as well as the Committee of 500. He and Jack Cook were great friends.
Very good.
Maybe it was Wadsworth that was found, but there was sort of an elder statesman of the businessmen.
It sounds like Duck Wadsworth.
And he had some company that produced Dell
watches. That's it. That's the thing. Watch cases. They had a contract during the war, World War II. Now, let me ask this. Could you add a sentence or so to the impact of the Kefauver Committee as background for this? Of course, I know, obviously, the Kefauver Committee did not have that big an impact because it continued after they'd gone. Did you get any impressions as you investigated or anything?
Well, there was a reform movement after a good, I think it's, it would be certainly, I'd have it documented in that Ford study in great detail because I was very fascinated with it. There was originally a Newport Reform Association or something that was set up as a result of the Kefauver hearings and findings. And that lasted for several years. But eventually, as I discovered, I think, the politician, the gamblers, Charlie Lester and his group managed to sort of take it over.
And manipulate it
and play them one off against the other. And so by the time Eisen went up there and the time this new crusade started, the old one was almost completely dead. It was just a memory. But there were some of the people who were later involved who had been very important in that original reform effort. But I've got it all spelled out there in that book.
We'll have to look.
Yeah.
Let me ask this. I gather that you feel Robert Kennedy personally deserves a great deal of credit for it.
Well, definitely. Kennedy, of course, had just organized this, started this coordinated war on crime, and he was looking for some quick successes. And one of them was the first was the Coppola case, which actually had been started before, but then Newport. He knew about Newport. Now, in 1960, he came to Newport campaigning for his brother. And he had a press conference. I asked him. There was a labor leader there, a former Teamster official. He was real close to him.
Jim Luke?
Yeah.
He died just the other
day. Anyway, he set up this press conference in Cincinnati. And I went up there for it. And Cincinnati reporters spent the whole period asking him about the religious issue, the Catholic issue, which actually was moot since Jack Kennedy just appeared before his ministers down in Texas the day or two before. So it was only at the end that I said, what about organized crime? And what about Newport? I pointed out the women and said, are you going to clean that place up? And he said, yes. And the Newport, that organized crime will be the number one target. And he said, what can an administration can't do anything about HOPA, do about organized crime, words to that effect. And so the interesting thing there was that next day the Cincinnati papers were full of the Catholic issue and said not a word was said about Newport. I had a complete scoop in the Courier Journal about what he'd said about crime. And he did remember. He knew what the score was. In other words, he didn't have to have anybody tell him. He knew what the score was. And when he became Attorney General, he made that a number one priority. The problem was finding a handle, a federal handle. And the boys couldn't have cooperated better by giving the frame violating Radiman civil rights, because that gave him the handle he was looking for. There's no question that without the federal pressure, and they had the IRS in there in great numbers, and subpoenaed practically all the financial records of the city. And the FBI was putting its whole energy in running down and checking out this frame. Without that, I don't think anything would have really happened. or it would have been a lot slower. But there's no question that Bobby Kennedy was one of the major factors in cleaning up Newport. He thought it sufficiently important that he made a special report to the president at the year's end as Attorney General. Newport had been a major gambling center in Newport, Kentucky. It had been cleaned up.
Could I just ask you about three or four local people, just any comment you really want to make? Of course, you mentioned Andy Charles.
He would not have been as successful as he was in getting started without the support, I'm sure, of Screw Andrew, Screw Andrew's lawyer, Screw Andrew's man. And Screw Andrews was a vicious son of a bitch. And looking at it particularly from a moral point of view, I couldn't like a guy who didn't work for Screw Andrews.
Mm-hmm.
Plus the fact that he was, in effect, giving Newport a degree of respectability and jollity or friendliness or cheerfulness or something that it didn't deserve by his being there. And so I don't think there's any question that he played ball with the mob and went along with it because that was the only way he could get ahead. Now, I don't think necessarily that he had a personal interest other than his career and his law practice, but still, he was, as far as I was concerned, he was one of the bad enemies.
Was Johnson, Don Johnson, had not, yeah, he'd been too young to have been involved. Right, he's now a state senator and a partner and a local political power, but obviously the name, Frank, you were going
to... Yeah, I was going to ask, how about Paul Stapleton?
He was one of those poor wishy-washy characters who, at least he had a little more sense than some of them. He was a little more objective, but he played ball with both sides. I think the funniest thing, I don't know if it's in that book or not, but it's in this study, was a little game with the snatch bar when he got word that there was gambling down there, and he sent the poor old sheriff down, and the sheriff, of course, called in advance and told him he was coming, and so forth, and he went back and forth with that little game for a while. But he, remember two things about him, right after Radiman's arrest, and after all the shit hit the fan, so to speak. Paul came up to me one day in the courthouse and said, Hank, am I wrong in thinking this thing is a lot bigger now than just Newport or just Kentucky? It's nationwide, isn't it? It's worldwide, man. We had the reporters from England and Germany coming over here. This was great. That's what I keep telling these buns. They think it's all going to blow over. They don't realize it's gotten out of hand. And I said, well, tell them that for once you're right. And then later, the next thing I remember about him was after I got that Ford Foundation grant, $25,000, he came up to me and said, how in the hell do you get $25,000? I've always wondered what a $25,000 a year man looked like. Now I know. It seemed to impress him all out of proportion. And frankly, that was one of the things that shocked me in Newport, was not necessarily Paul, but some of those cops, some of those others, who sold themselves down the river to this syndicate, to these gangsters, for peanuts. Some of those cops thought they were doing well to get a change, a new suit once a year out of the, or a hat,
uh-huh,
or something. And they really didn't get a lot of money, but they were making possible this multi-million-dollar operation and just taking peanuts in return. And so when Stapleton, that circuit judge, was so impressed with the guy making $25,000, I thought, my God, what a penny ante in mind he must have.
Was Johnny Peluso around then? He was pretty young.
Yeah, he came along after Johnny TV. He had his TV store, and he, of course, ran for mayor the first time after all that. He was a comic figure, whatever there was.
He still is.
Yes, he's been indicted.
It was typical of Newport that they'd elect a bum like that. I mean,
of course, this must have been good working stuff for the syndicate. That's the kind of place you want to go in.
Oh, yeah.
He owns the... what was the Yorkshire Club, which is now, he now rents to the state of Kentucky for human services office.
But Larry, if you want to understand the mafia, if you understand Newport as it was then at least, then you can begin to see how a mafia could exist.
Mm-hmm.
Because the people, that's why I was so shocked to hear about a university. People there at that time were so goddamn ignorant, semi-illiterate. I mean, that's a mess of rank and file of them. They believed anything. I remember a reporter who could write this story saying Newport's got the best police department in the country. Well, they believed it. They didn't know anything. One of the chief arguments against they used against the Courier-Journal was conditions in Newport are no worse than they are in Louisville, in the other big city. Well, nobody, these guys had never been to any of the other cities. They didn't know. They believed what they were told. And they just thought this was a natural way of life because they didn't know any better. And so you can see how a godfather or a mobby could really get started. And they thought they were big shots to get just a few dollars in return for permitting this to go on. They lived in filth, and they thought this was the way people, everybody did. So they were ignorant, they were stupid, and these guys took advantage of it.
Let me just add, I don't know that there is any possible connection here, because Earl Clements had been defeated for the Senate, of course, in 56 by Morton. But did you run into any echoes of Earl Clements when you were in northern Kentucky? There is any connection he may have had with anything else?
Well, there was some suggestions, yes, and there was some one particular guy that later on was identified as being a big shot in Newport when he really wasn't. But yeah, he got his name, but it wasn't as important. The basic thing, the political thing Newport had was that the boys there, the gang, the big boys at least, contributed equally to both sides. So Newport, in a sense, was sort of a source of money, and in return, and they left it alone. And I don't think either one side had the advantage. It was almost as if there was a gentleman's agreement that you wouldn't make an issue out of it.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until the Courier-Journal stirred up the political scene in 1961, and Bert Combs got in there, and Happy Chandler, of course, was a natural issue. As Happy had already gone along and made that famous statement that the people of Newport had the right to have it dirty. And in a sense, you didn't see why, but on the other hand, Newport was still part of the state of Kentucky. You could, I know, for example, when I drive up to Newport, I could relax in one sense when I got inside Kenton County, or Campbell County, as far as the state patrol was concerned. I got stopped several times further down by the state patrol for crossing a red line or something. But once in there, you knew the state patrol didn't come into that area. It was as if it was a little Mexico, a separate entity. And as far as the state was concerned, well, this was part of the sort of the understanding. I think the politicians of both sides had. They just leave them there in their own filth. And they wanted to have it dirty, okay. But they, in return, they contributed so much. I don't think they got as much as they should have, because I don't think they really understood how big of the operation was.
I guess that's, you know, that's very good, because I think that has always, and still to a degree, exists there. Jesus, you know, the university in the center of that, and it still is so parochial and provincial, and they believe that if you go past Ludlow, you drop off into black chaos. Obviously you knew what Tucker, that you kind of liked him, didn't you, if that's the right word?
He was a friendly fellow, yeah. He lived in Newport. I didn't know him when he left Newport when I was, and all this started. They had other allegedly local men running things. I interviewed him on the Ford Grand down here in Miami. He's a Miami Bee. And I brought him briefly into prominence down here in the Miami Herald, and then once I stopped writing about him, he dropped back into silence. Only one you ever hear about anymore was the big boy Mo Davis out in first middle of Las Vegas, and then out to La Costa Country Club in San Diego. But they took a deposition. Mo sued somebody for libel several years ago, and they took his deposition, and he said, "I've been mentioned in 13 books, 10 of them by Hank Messick. That doesn't make me a public figure because nobody reads the Hank Messick book." I got that statement. He sent me a copy of the deposition.
I got the impression the major thing that organized crime exploited in Northern Kentucky besides gambling was probably prostitution.
Well, I don't think that organized crime, or at least syndicate crime,
had anything to do with it.
Because I think that, on the whole, they might have permitted a few high-class call girl types out in Beverly Hills. But their problem was, and it's a problem any community would have, is that you can be half pregnant. And they would have been content just to have had the Beverly Hills running and closed down everything else.
But they couldn't because they had to make the deal with the local cops. The cops take a payoff, the sheriff's office takes a payoff to let the Beverly run, and they're going to take it from somebody else to let the Yorkshire run or the some of those bus ads on. And so the paper was, or the syndicate, I think, was concerned about the prostitution because it figured this is where the public will get indignant. They'll never get indignant over clean gambling and high-class entertainment, but if they get indignant, it'll be over the prostitution. And that was the thing that had started back in the early 50s, after the key fall. It was the prostitution, the vice, that got the public aroused a little bit then. So that is why I started this thing. When I told you my first assignment to Newport was after the word got out the cops were going to close down the prostitution. The vice that is what they would use ever so often to try to throw a sop out that they're doing something. But the thing is, and this became apparent later on, they didn't have the power. The cops didn't have the power, even if they wanted to close down the prostitutes. The boys were too, the hood, the punks, the pimps or whatnot, were too strong politically. And so I think that there were times when they would have loved to have closed down some of those joints simply for the public record to allow the gambling to go on.
Right.
And they made that, offered that deal to Reverend Barkow, I think. I got at one point, I mean, I've got that spelled out here, but they went to him and said, look, if you call off your people, we'll make you a deal. We'll close down the prostitution and let the gambling run. Well, Barca, he'd been there a long, long time. And he thought that was a pretty good accomplishment. He went to the Ministerial Association and they refused to go along with it, much to his disgust. But I don't think that the prostitution wasn't all that important to the syndicate. They would have much preferred to have a clean gambling operation.
That was that would be a threat to their smooth running.
Yeah, and that's of course ultimately what happened. It was in the bust out joints that gave the place a bad name, but they got so that they created this Frankenstein's monster. And if you had one, you were going to have the other, and they couldn't stop it. Let's say the cops couldn't even close down the gambling, the prostitution places when they wanted to.
Was Eisner around?
Sammy Eisner.
I remember the name for many of the dozens.
They were probably part of the local, maybe along the lines of what Pete Schmidt and. But Eisner was killed what 2 years ago, 3 years ago now.
There were three or four brothers and an old man. I think they were out of the mountains originally. Who had what the hell were the names? They had three or four prostitution places.
Was that Taylor, Levinson? I remember.
They were illiterate hillbillies. I'm a hillbilly myself, so I use the word advice. They were great big hulking bastards, and they eventually got indicted by the federal grand jury because they were one of the first indictments returned. One of the funniest things I've got is a letter that one of them wrote spilling the beans, and I mean, what a Toggy Valley could write. He was trying to make a deal, and he wrote a long, rambling letter about how things went on there and who was behind it all. So he didn't know really much about it, but what he knew, he knew. But I know they scared me to death when that one, you know, one of the ministers and I were going around. We left one joint, and it turned back into one of his sons. He had three or four sons who was following us. And we had to hide in an alley behind the garbage cans to get away from the guy. He was just following us 10 or 20 feet behind us. He was a frightening figure, huge, hulking, dirty looking.
Did you respect the state police? I take it from the...
The state police didn't do anything. They couldn't, you know, go in there until 61 when they finally declared a state of emergency and they came rolling in there. So, I mean, they were on our side and they worked beautifully.
And then the FBI, as it was pulled in, after they got in, what did this depend so much on the local agent and how much?
They sent in a whole batch of the man in charge was from Louisville, Frank Stott, who put in charge of the investigation. But they sent in, I mean, Kennedy gave the order.
Right.
They said, we're going to use this Ratterman case as a handle. He got out there and proved that he was framed. And so they went in there and did what they had to do and did a damn good job of that type of thing. The IRS, of course, made cases on the wagering tax law, under the wagering tax law, that these bastards had been cheating on that even. They hadn't reported anywhere near the amount they should have. So it was a combined effort. Now, all three, I might say the state, which was putting on pressure through these hearings to remove some of the public officials, you know. That was their angle. Mm-hmm. The federal government was using the taxes and the violation of civil rights. And locally, of course, they were using, trying to use the special grand jury to get rid of some of the officials. So it was a concerted, coordinated, three-headed campaign that finally got results. But I still say without the damn papers putting up the pressure. You had to create the opportunity that the politicians could take advantage of to get profit, political profit. I mean, nobody heard about Newport, it wouldn't have done them any good politically to clean it up. But once it became a statewide scandal, then they could go in there and make themselves heroes, which is what they did.
Do you know offhand of anyone who was involved on the side of crime who was criminally north at that time that be possible for us to talk to in the country?
They're scattered now, so I wouldn't know who's alive and who isn't. They were running to Tito Currency. He used to be down here, but he got indicted again recently. I imagine he's back in jail. He'd beaten the rap all the time. You know, he'd beat it in up there. But eventually, they got him home with income tax and a dozen other violations. I saw his name about 3 or 4 months ago. Just some obscure little story where he'd been indicted again. No, I don't know who the hell you're getting at, but there must be plenty of them. Screw Andrews died.
Yes, he did.
He would have been the
He would never
I guess he would have.
I'd say if you get to go to him, look up Leroy Fredericks. I mean, he was...
Leroy Fredericks.
Yeah. He was an honest guy. And he could tell you more about what went on from the crook's point of view than some of the crooks.
Do you ever hear from Ratterman?
We kept in touch, and at one point he wanted me to write a book about him, but I think he wanted it for political reasons.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but he never did anything. But I haven't heard from him in a long time. Where is he, man?
Colorado.
Back in Denver. No, I think he moved to, came back. I heard he was in Toledo.
He did move back. He moved back east. That's right, Frank. Yes, and I've forgotten what he was with Coca-Cola Company in Denver for a while. And then the last article I saw was about a week ago, and I just skimmed it. I just looked at his picture to see what he looked like now, and it seemed like he was in local politics and real estate, or some kind of a combination.
Real estate,
like this,
I think. Uh-huh. His wife was Ed Hindlebrock, his sister.
Well, Hindlebrock was another one of these businessmen. She was a beautiful girl, too.
I
really admired her. She stood behind him. So they were sure. To give you an example of how these poor bums are, the night Ratterman was acquitted in police court, which was a tremendous shock to everybody. I went back to this little motel in Covington that I'd been staying at, and I got acquainted with the desk man there. He was always good for the latest rumor. He was trying to make the best of a situation. Well, anyway, I just got the word. I said, what word? He said, well, Ann Ratterman's moved out. She's not going to put up with George. And April Flowers thing at least broke that up. Got that much out of it. I went into a loud life. Said, I just left the Ratterman home, and Ann kissed me on the cheeks and said, I've never seen a happier person in my life. But they were so desperate putting out lies like that just to satisfy them. Themselves somehow, but it was so personal, so vindictive about it. You see.
How did
they could never forgive Ratterman because they thought he was sort of one of the boys type.
That he would get in and
they could never believe he was sincere. They nicknamed him Saint George, you know.
How did he get into it, by the way? What was the catalyst for it? Was he?
Well, I think it was through probably his brother-in-law, Engelbrook or whatnot. They got first the ministers got going, and then they had. Businessmen came in and they were looking around for political candidates, and I guess George had a few ambitions, but I think the challenge of it as much as anything deals with it. And I know when he made his acceptance speech above the library up there, he said, I won't do this unless you all are going to back me up. I said, they all promised to back him up. But he was he scared him to death one time, he just disappeared. They couldn't find him anywhere for several hours. I'm sure he'd been kidnapped. Turned out that his anti reformers had been holding a meeting down in the basement of some snack bar, I think. He'd gone down there, just walked in and got up on the stage and started debating with him, tried to make a speech.
Well, it took some physical courage.
I tell you, the only time in my life in Newport that I could not find a minister or a layman to go with me was the night after Radiman had been arrested with April Flower. And I'd gotten a call that morning saying all hell broken loose, so I'd gone up there. I phoned in my story, and I decided I would finish off the day by going over to the, whatever the name of it was, the nightclub and watching April Flower. And nobody would go with me. It was the only time that I had that experience. Nobody would go with me. Jack Cook finally agreed to drive me over there, and he let me off three blocks from my Monmouth Street. And so I walked in there by myself. And it was I had to laugh when I got in there, because it soon became apparent the only people in there were FBI agents. The place was full of FBI agents. Where April came out and did her dance.
Was she good looking?
Oh, not really.
Typical.
She was, had a big nose. But I remember her dance. She, her costume was spangled with little mirrors that reflected on the wall. And she stripped until there was just one little mirror left. But there was even nobody in there. Tito Carenzi came in and said, "How in the hell did you get in here?" Called in his doorman bodyguard and said, "Take a good look at this guy. Don't ever let him in here again." And I was almost afraid to eat after I saw the FBI agents, and one of them identified himself. So
you were harassed, and you were they attempted to bribe you, and there were times when it got to be. Did you ever fear the local police?
Yeah, I was more scared of the police.
I would think, yeah.
Well, I was afraid I was being framed. I'd sneak into town, try to stay there as long as I could. Sooner or later, somebody'd spot me and they'd wait, "Hey, Hank," and word would be all over town within 5 minutes. Any place I went, they knew I was coming.
Where did you stay?
Well, during the actual trial, there was a little motel over there right by the bridge in Covington.
Travelodge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then I...
in Covington or Newport?
Covington.
In Covington, it's the...
Holiday Inn now, isn't it?
No, I know which one it is. Yeah. I'll show you. It's where the Chamber of Commerce is now, and I can't think of the name of it.
It was right by the bridge, which is one reason I picked it.
Yeah,
right. I had to go to Cincinnati to file my stories. But there wasn't any place to stay in Newport in those days. There wasn't a hotel in Newport except the Glen. I went in there in my FBA. Innocence, one of my first trips up there, and tried to register. And they said, "Well, you ain't got no room for it. That's where all the girls live." For a long time there, I stayed in Cincinnati in one of the hotels, because paper was scared something had happened to me. I thought I'd be safer in a Cincinnati hotel than anywhere else. But after a while, they just sort of accepted me, and nobody at first thought anything was going to come out of it. I was sort of a joke, and everybody. Even the reporters on the Cincinnati papers would look at you and grin as if they knew something, what a damn fool this guy is chasing his tail. And as I say, it wasn't surprising, because that's the way they felt back up the Courier Journal, too. So.
I thought you were a gadfly, kind of their irritant in residence.
Yeah. Well, I appeared before more grand juries, and it was that was another thing that I was worried about, for through the wires that end up having them indict me or something. But one time they put sugar in my gas tank when I'd been up there. Like a damn fool, I just parked my whole car right out on Resort Street. When I came back, started home, I got about halfway down the road and the car stopped. And I finally got it pulled into a filling station, and they found they first looked at the fuel pump, and it was just choked with sugar. Eventually, I had to leave it, and they sent a plane after me to get me home. Went back, and man said, "We dumped 5 pounds of sugar out of your gas tank." If they hadn't put in so much, you'd have really had trouble. Put in so much, it choked it off and didn't spread it throughout the motor. So I took that fuel pump, choked the sugar, I took it back up to Newport and went before the grand jury and showed it to them. Part of my motive there was pull a trick. They show them a few stick tricks like this, and they won't pull it anymore. But the first 3 or 4 years that I was there, before every grand jury, I think they met, and it was a hostile experience each time. It was only finally in 1960 that you began to get grand juries that were a little more friendly to you.
Yeah. I guess we're kind of coming to the end of this, and I was going to ask you a little bit, you know, how, what you're doing today. Are you writing on a book now? You just finished.
Well, I just had one published, and I just finished another one.
You finished what the last one on here was the one I liked. What was it?
Grass and Snow.
Grass and Snow, and that was the last one published,
that
right?
That was just published last month.
Last month. And you're working on.
I have written another one in the meantime. When that'll be published.
What is it?
It's a little different. It's a nonfiction book, but I, for the first time, changed all the names. One of the problems, as I indicated earlier, in writing nonfiction about crime is that they don't want to be informed, they want to be entertained. So this story is about IRS intelligence agent who used sex as a secret weapon. Farm boy out of Iowa who had a pitted face from an overdose of radiation the jury's acting when he was a boy out there, and also made him sterile as it turned out. But he had a great attraction for women. They just wanted to mother him, I suppose. But anyway, he learned how to be, he was a great lover, and so he used sex as his secret weapon all through these years making all these cases. So he now retired and permitted me to tell the story. I tried to write it as a straight nonfiction using all the names, but there was too much he didn't let me tell. And so I changed all the names and was able to go into great detail about his experiences. The title of the book is Naked Strangers.
Uh-huh.
Part of that comes from the fact that while he was able to meet and sleep with all these women, they remained strangers in a sense, but he never really understood them. So I don't know. That's sort of an experiment.
And you still travel quite a lot then, don't you?
Well, not as much as I used to, but still get around whenever I'm having to research. But of course, being here in this area is one great advantage. I went to Washington and I had to see a guy in Louisiana researching up grass and snow. But most of it I was able to do just going down to Miami and talking to them. This was a scene of port of entry for most of the all the cocaine and most of the marijuana into coming into this country. The one book, you might be interested in this since you're from Kentucky, the one book I've written that is not about crime and corruption is King's Mountain, which I wrote and managed to get published for the Bicentennial.
About the Battle of
the Battle of King's Mountain. And of course, as you know, one of the heroes of that battle was the first governor of Kentucky, Isaac Shelby.
Right.
So the book, in effect, is how the hillbillies of the Blue Ridge Mountains, including what's now Tennessee and some from the skirts of Virginia and some came in from South Carolina, but anyway, how they won the Battle of King's Mountain and sent Cornwallis to Yorktown a year later. And I consider it, and it's so marked by the federal government, one of the decisive battles, a turning point in the revolution, but he never really got any publicity to speak of.
And that came out in 1776.
And one of the things I was able to use to great advantage was the unpublished manuscript by Isaac Shelby, which I found in the library, University of Chicago library. Never been published. Basically, it was supposed to be his autobiography, but basically it was just a story of the King's Mountain campaign. So I was able to get a copy of that. Great link, because Shelby was a real hero.
Was that in that Draper collection?
No, he made some references to it.
Right.
But no, I don't believe he did. Draper didn't. No, this is that's at the University of Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah, that's true, Mitch. Mm-hmm.
This is a special, well, I can show you that. Maybe I had to give him credit. It's a special collection at the University of Chicago. And I was fascinated by not only Shelby, but John C. Beer. You know, served first governor of Tennessee and served 12 terms. And there's another Kings Mountain guy who became governor of North Carolina. I mean, those were real men, real heroes. And what I got carried away, in a sense, what I wanted to do, and it's still left to do, is carry on the story, basically, of the hillbilly, of the Blue Ridge Mountain, here, to speak, basically Scotch, Irish, but there was some French and German mixed in with it, and show the second book would carry it that I projected carried through the War of 1812, when Isaacs led an army from Kentucky Riflemen and they jumped off at Newport.
Yeah.
And I still think, I think there's some historical signs that they went on up into Canada and defeated the British and Indians at the Battle of the Thames. Yeah, that was more decisive, actually, than New Orleans. He got a gold medal and was made the Secretary of War. He didn't serve. He turned it down because he was too old. I'd like to tell that book next.
Oh, good. We'll get. Who publishes your books? Is there one?
No, I have different publishers.
They're different publishers.
Little yeah. Brown published that one.
Little Brown.
But
we'll mention that one.
If you can find me a grant, which I'd like to. I've done a lot of the research. I'd like to write that, and I think it'd be of vast importance to Kentucky to have that story told.
I think it.
You never seen King's Mind?
You know, I was just thinking, Lou, since you mentioned it, I didn't even notice the author at the time, but casually George Jones said he has this book on King's Mind. You know, he's from North Carolina.
That's right.
And I would never in the world have identified Mr. Messick with that particular volume, which I didn't have time to look at. He just mentioned he wanted me to see.
Listen, Frank, we're coming at the end of this, and I just want to thank Mr.